is KHOY Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, are your hosts for today. Hello, Gina.
Hello, Susan. As the local talk farm reporter, I'm really excited about today's program. We're going to learn about the Iowa Learning Farms and that they had a visitor from Australia, and also about amaranth, that is a problematic weed as well as a good food crop.
Yes, I think it'll be a great program. But we're starting today's program with some breaking news. With Dennis Hart bringing news in from area newspaper, it's exciting to be able to bring you news we haven't read in the papers yet.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
As our regular listeners know, Ames has invested a lot of time and professional expertise in developing the plans for a solar farm as part of the future energy portfolio for our municipal electric utility. The way it would work, citizens could buy power packs that would pay for the purchase of installing and upkeep of SunSmart Ames, the solar farm, which is designed to generate 2 megawatts of electricity for purchase by Ames Electric Services. Because the city council had declared that it would not proceed until 80% of the power packs had been pledged, there was some suspense whether the vote at the city council last night would kill the possibility for a solar farm. I took my recorder to the city council last night expecting drama, but what I heard was not what I expected. The portion of the council meeting that dealt with solar power lasted an hour and 23 minutes. So, for the 8-minute collage of the deliberations, it just gives a feeling for the discussion. Note that the vote on the solar farm occurs halfway through. The real drama came with net metering, which hasn't gotten much discussion so far.
Okay, moving on, item 26, Community Solar Project.
Mayor, ladies and gentlemen of the council, Donald Kamm, Electric Services Director. What I wanted to talk a little bit about tonight is our community solar project that we're looking at building here. If you notice from the council action form, I actually went back to 2016. That's when we first started looking at this project, and I want to briefly step through the entire process that we went through to get us to tonight. So back in 2016, one of the things that we started looking at was we were starting to see people putting solar panels on their own homes. But we had a huge group of customers within the city of Ames that either didn't own a home, they were renters, their house was facing the wrong direction, or they simply didn't have the means to spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to put solar panels on their homes. So we started looking, could we do a community solar project? And we basically came up with a community solar project. The first thing that we did was we asked the question, should this be owned by the city, or what kind of model should we look at? So we hired a consultant, Tom Wind. Interesting name to be looking at a solar project, but Tom Wind was the guy. And looked at that, came back to council, and the idea was is with federal tax incentives, it actually worked out better to have it owned by a third party, and then they would own it, maintain it, operate it. Then we would take the power off of that and then provide that here to the city. We wanted some options so that at some point, if it was worth our while, we'd have the ability to purchase it. So we also then looked at different models that after a period of time, about 6 to 7 years, we could actually purchase it if we wanted to and own it from there. And there are pluses and minuses to that. The other piece of that model that we looked at had to do with, should we bring this generation on like we do other things? We went out and actually purchased 36 megawatts of wind, brought it into our portfolio. We have a generation plant at the end of Main Street. We've got other forms of generation. It was interesting in talking to most people in Ames and said, you know, do you have any green renewable energy? And no one knows that we actually have 36 megawatts of wind that sits about 8 miles outside of town. So we said, let's look at a different model. Let's get the community more engaged in this. So the model we looked at is something similar to what Cedar Falls Utilities has done with their project, and it was build it and then allow any business, any customer that wishes to participate in the project to have a stake in it, have a share, if you will. And we had several meetings. URAB had quite a few meetings in 2016, 2017, looking at the price structure, how to develop it, you know, how to encourage our customers. And if you saw in the council action form, we did a wide range of trying to get the word out. Anything from radio programs. We had Channel 12. We've got we talked to every group that would listen to us, Kiwanis and many church groups. In fact, church groups happen to be probably one of our best allies in this, because people then not only were looking at these projects for their own home, but they had the ability to purchase them on behalf of somebody else and kind of have a living legacy. So a lot of churches have come to us wanting 100, 150 of these power packs, as we call them, to get involved in the project. So time is going on. People continue to call us and say, I'd like some power packs. And we've been at this almost 2 years. And we're at a point now where we're close to this 80%, and I'll touch on that. But we're at a point now where some of the original customers are saying, are you guys going to build this? And we're at about 72% now. In fact, 2 hours ago, one guy walked in and said, well, I bought one 3 months ago. Can I get two more? And so we're starting to see a lot of people saying, now's the time I really want to get involved. So that 72 continues to go up. So we haven't met that 80% threshold. And let me talk about that. Where did that 80% threshold come from? That was actually set by staff when we first came to council 2 years ago with the idea of we wanted to make sure that there was a strong interest in community solar. So that was something that staff set. We didn't want to come to you with 30% spoken for or 40 or 50. We wanted to be able to make sure that we could come to you and say that there's a strong interest in this project. And at 72%, I think we're going to reach 80% fairly quickly.
I'll open this up to public input. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to address council on this particular topic? And if so, I'd ask you to limit your comments to 3 minutes or less. Seeing none, we'll close public input, and council entertain a motion on resolution.
Sorry, to award an energy services agreement to Forefront Power of San Francisco, California, to construct and maintain a 2-megawatt community solar farm at the airport site at a contract price of
$9 per megawatt hour.
Any further discussion? All right, roll call, please.
Aye.
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 All right, very good. And well, we appreciate the applause. I will say this has been a community undertaking. We appreciate everyone's support. We got a lot of emails encouraging us, but I think that council has been behind this project for a long time, so. Item 27, retail solar net metering update.
This is me again. So in talking about this, so we've talked about the community solar side of it. Originally, we started by encouraging and helping our customers put in solar. And there's a process or a program called net metering. It's part of it. So when a customer, whether it's a homeowner or a business, puts on a solar panel, it's basically installed what we call behind the meter. So in other words, any energy that it produces, it's first used by the house. So we don't see it. It doesn't appear on our system. And it basically reduces the amount of energy that a customer buys from us. And that's great. One of the things we started seeing after about the first couple of installations is there was a strong desire for people to install what I would say more than they're using at a given time. So if their load was 8 kilowatts, we started seeing 10, 12, 14 kilowatts installed. And although that's not a large problem from an individual standpoint, we had to have a way, and this is what net metering is, we had to have a way of how do you deal with that excess energy? And as we were building our net metering program for the first few, what happens is if your load is 5 kilowatts and you're producing 10, that those 5 kilowatts would come onto the system, and then the customer could pull it back at any time that they needed it.
I'm Irv Kloss. I think the most important question in the world right now is whether a capitalistic society like the United States and a capitalistic international order like the one we all live in is capable of reducing our greenhouse emissions enough to sustain life. It's that serious. And so this question you're addressing tonight is very important because I represent the climate action team, and we have been and will continue to advocate for more solar energy in this city. In fact, we would like to see 100% renewable in this city in 10 years. Now, imagine that. What happens when 30 to 40% or maybe even 50% of the houses in this city begin producing electricity with solar means? Or what if we changed our ordinances so that we could put solar on our flat roofs of all of our commercial buildings? Or what if we put canopies on our big parking lots on campus and put solar panels on those so we could charge the electric cars that are going to come, that will be coming down the line in a few years, probably sooner than you think? So the question you're dealing with right now is very important to that future. And I hope that you can resolve it fairly, because as Don has pointed out, these fixed costs would be paid, almost all of it, by those people who don't have solar panels. But if they have solar panels, then they reap the benefits. And maybe that's an incentive for them, for everybody to put solar panels on their houses, which would be great. But as we pointed out, not everybody can do that.
I would like to see council, we're the body of elected officials here, and I would like to see council actually move towards a greater incentivization, not just getting more information about what other people are doing, because our budget and our rates and our priorities reflect our values, and I think this is an area where we can make a difference. We can encourage construction of some solar systems that aren't being built right now, that are not going to break the bank. In our current ordinance, we already have a 2-megawatt limit on solar installations. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And so the solar farm is an additional 2 megawatts that we're constructing. But if we just look at the amount that we're spending on the solar farm and the amount that we're talking about this other thing, it's kind of out of whack that this is so hard to do. So I guess I would amend the motion to ask for an eye towards improving the incentives for solar.
I don't want to make a motion that promises anyone that we're going to increase an incentive without the information first.
Maybe this. I mean, if our intent is to look towards increasing the incentives, then I think it's important for URAB to understand that, to take that knowledge of what council wants into account when they're doing the technical analysis. That given this discussion, I think I'm comfortable with the motion.
Here comes the sun. It's all right.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and this is KHOI with your hosts, Susan Franzen, and myself, Gina McAndrews. Hey, it's time to get out into the country, and we'll be doing that with our first guest, Jacqueline Comito. She's the Program Director at Iowa State University's Iowa Learning Farms. Hello, Jackie.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm good. It's a beautiful morning.
It sure is. Glad we broke that heat a little.
Yes, thank goodness.
Hey, would you be so kind to tell us a little bit about the Iowa Learning Farm and what you do and what its purpose?
Well, the Iowa Learning Farms is celebrating its 15th year of existence this year. So we were initiated those years ago to be a farmer demonstration and outreach project on conservation practices. So we go across the whole state. We have 88 farmer partners that we've worked with in various capacities through the years. They'll either host field days, come in and do leadership circles, go out and speak to farmers in other capacities to help encourage the adoption of a handful of conservation practices, most of which are actually included in the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, but we actually predate that, so we were doing that before that was a thing. And we've had good success through the years in terms of building an energy and a dialogue around why we should be doing these important environmental practices.
Do you want to tell us some of the programs and practices that you're involved with?
Yeah, well, when we first started, a lot of what we were doing was reducing tillage practice, no-till, and then strip-till came around. But very, very quickly after we started, cover crops started to become discussed and on the horizon, and we were one of the early groups, along with in a partnership with Practical Farmers of Iowa, who were really advocating for cover crops. So one of our hallmarks is a 10-year-old on-farm research project, or demonstration, I should say, demonstration research, where farmers were putting cover crops on their own fields in a side-by-side comparison. And so we're actually, from our understanding, this is one of the only long-term on-farm cover crop demonstrations out there. We're just wrapping that up this year, and then we'll be releasing that report. Some of the other practices, we have helped promote prairie strips and the strips project. We obviously, all the edge of field practices such as bioreactors, saturated buffer. In fact, a new addition to our program a couple of years, or last year, was one of our conservation stations now actually features workable models of saturated buffers and bioreactors. And right now, we have a couple of students who are working on a hands-on wetland example, too, so that there is a hand-on activity that we can take out to county fairs to really show people how these CREP wetlands would work, how these nutrient reduction wetlands would work. So we do the variety. We go, you name a conservation practice, and in some way or another, we are helping promote it across the state.
Well, that sure is terrific. There's quite a variety of projects you have working on. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit? They probably aren't familiar with bioreactions and conservation or concentrated. What did you say?
Saturated buffers.
Yes, buffers.
Well, I'm gonna. You know, first of all, I'm gonna stress that I'm an anthropologist, not like a bioengineer. So I'm not going to get into the real hard science of a bioreactor, but just in a nutshell, it is a big trench that you put wood chips in that you then make tile water run through. So you divert the tile water through it, and then there are bacteria and things in those wood chips that will then help clean and take the nitrates out of that, turn it into the gas, which is a lot safer. And so science has shown really good reductions in helping clean water through those bioreactors. They usually help clean about, I think they can do 10 to 20 acres of land, and don't quote me on that. So farmers will put them in specific areas where land drains appropriately with tile to help clean the water. So that is a technique that I think we've got maybe 60 of those across the state to begin with. We need a whole lot more of those if we're going to be successful. And then a saturated buffer is relatively a new approach that really works with Mother Nature, where what the argument there is, if you divert the water into a buffer through a specific, so the tile goes into another whole tile network that goes more lateral, then the buffer will help clean that water before it gets into the creek or the river. And so that's actually really good. And that's actually catching on very quickly, because I think farmers find that very appealing, that you're going to take something that already existed and make it a little more useful.
So it's a little bit like a wetland before it goes into the river.
Well, yes. Same idea.
Concept.
Yes.
Wise anyway.
Yeah.
So have you been getting a lot of farmers that are interested in these various practices?
Yeah, I mean, so we just published a big 15-year report, because I am one of the things about the Iowa Learning Farms is that it is funded by a partnership of organizations, and so I have a lot of accountability that I've had to do through the years. So when we hit 15 years, I decided to do do a survey with all the farmers who have attended a field day through the years. We've done over 256 field days over the 15 years. And just to see, you know, what did you do? Have you changed anything? Have you added practices? And also, you know, I mean, the farmers that come to our field days, 40-some percent of them have cover crops. Quite a few of them have no-till or strip-till, something like that. You know, because there's not that many saturated buffers or bioreactors, you know, not that many of the people reporting back to have had those, but a lot of the bioreactors and saturated buffers, the farms that have those, have come to our field days, so trying to find other information. One thing we know about our field days, or one thing we know about field days, is that farmers use field days as a way to gain confidence and give a reason why they could take the risk to do some of these practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I think sometimes we think, you know, an extension, and you, I know, Gina, you've been around extension for a while, too. We think all we're doing is giving them information, and all they need is information, and then that information is going to help them make a decision. And I think one of the things Learning Farms has introduced is say, well, no, actually what they need more than information is to look around and say, who else is doing this? And if they're doing it, maybe I should do it too.
Right. Seeing examples on the ground and learning from other colleagues about, you know, specific practices and things that have worked on their farm and they've had luck with. And
well, and they're also farmers or humans like we are. So they're saying, well, you know, if my neighbor's willing to take a risk, then maybe I can take a risk.
Right, right.
And it's that risk-averse thing. They're, you know, incredibly risk-averse for a lot of reasons. And so it's that. So field days are also just about gaining that social support for something you might be interested in doing. I like to say that the Iowa Learning Farms is really, we've had a big role in helping the innovators find a platform to share what they're doing, and then the early adapters, we've educated a lot of early adapters, but now first 15 years maybe was easy. I think our hard work is ahead of us as we try to get increase those practices and get higher numbers.
Your hard work is ahead of you.
Yeah, the hardest work is ahead of us, that's for sure.
You mean getting more farmers involved? Or?
Yeah, well, getting more farmers to plant cover crops. If you've already gotten the innovators and the beginning of the early adapters, mm-hmm. it just gets harder to get the rest of the farmers.
What are some of your main crops, your cover crops that you've had luck with? And are
well,
there
you know
good
what,
markets
actually, cover
for those?
Crops, we've done a variety of, we've had other research projects where we've looked at mixes, and then we've looked at single species. And I think the Learning Farms and Practical Farmers of Iowa reached the conclusion now that we really just encourage single species, especially if you're beginning, because the cost of doing a mixture and the benefits of doing that mixture doesn't outweigh the cost because mm-hmm. of whether the cover crop will be successful or not. So, of course, rye, cereal rye is the Cadillac of cover crops in terms of ease of being able to get it established, and because it overwinters, so you get it both in the late fall and then it comes back strong in the spring. So cereal rye, oats are good. It just depends on what your goals are, and then wheat. Single species is really probably the way to go.
And for people that aren't familiar with that, they plant that in the fall, correct?
Yeah, so a cover crop is something, so basically the whole motto here is where we're moving to is trying to mimic what the earth would do anyway, which is, you know, the earth hates a void, and so if there's bare ground, something's going to start growing in there. And so what we do with a cover crop is we deliberately plant something so we can have green out there as for as much of the time, especially in the spring when we get all those big heavy rains to prevent soil erosion, to build up all the nice things in soil, having that root system, it encourages earthworms. We also have a real fun project that really looks at earthworms and cover crops. It'll increase earthworms in the area, which helps the soil in so many ways. Again, I'm not a soil scientist. I'm a social scientist, but those are, you know, that's what we recommend.
And then for those that aren't familiar with that, they're planting the corn and soybeans right into that crop.
Yes, they are. So usually if you're going to plant corn, you want to get that cover crop terminated a couple of weeks before that. And soybeans, we find that they're pretty hardy with rye, so you can just get them planted almost immediately.
So it's primarily as a cover crop, and they're not harvesting the grain or anything
Well,
like
they're
that.
Not, but some farmers are beginning to grow it just for the seed because, you know, the more acres we get of cover crop, the more seed we're going to need. So they, for some farmers, that can become a little side business.
There you go.
And putting that, and then putting that in land, you know, maybe a little bit marginal land, maybe, you know, somewhere where it can do, you know, we're having a crop of cover crop. But mostly, yes, it is really just as a cover to keep the green out there. And I don't know you, if you're out driving in the country in the spring, because these cover crops will come up as soon as they get the right temperature and right moisture to do it. And if the snow's gone, it is such a joy to see green out there in March.
Well, it sure sounds like you've been doing a lot of variety and innovative projects here in Iowa. And I've heard there's a few people coming from different countries even to learn more about your projects.
Yeah, it was kind of exciting. We did host a guest from all the way from Australia who, well, obviously they do a different kind of agriculture in Australia, a lot different than what we do here in Iowa. When she got hired to be the director of the Sustainable Farms, she was looking around the internet to find if there were any similar programs that she could learn from. Because like me, she was a social scientist put into this program. And so she happened upon our website and started seeing, you know, we try to keep a lot of what we're doing up on the website. And she came across our field day toolkit and all the evaluation work I did and she started adapting it to her project. I got an email from her last fall basically saying, hey, I would like to be able to Skype with you to discuss this. I really like your program. This is what I'm doing. So we talked then and I actually invited her if she wanted to come here and see it firsthand, and she took me up on that. So we just finished a 12-day visit.
Yes, we had a really nice interview with her that she was very impressed and said she was really impressed with everything we're doing here, or you're doing here in Iowa, and other folks with PFI and Leopold Center and that sort of thing.
Yeah, she loved our trailers, too, the conservation station fleet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
she loved
she
them
did.
Because it is such a way. You know, so one of the unique things that Iowa Learning Farms actually brings to this whole thing is we say that it isn't good enough just talking to the farmers. We have to talk to everybody the farmers talk to.
Right.
That means a community outreach program, and that's our trailers.
Well, that's something that Michelle Young talked about, too, and we were fortunate enough to have an interview with her just the day before she left. So she has a few things to say about what she learned from Iowa Learning Farms. Thank you so much for coming on today to tell us about it. And now we'll hear what the visitor from Australia had to say.
Hey, thanks, ladies.
Thank you, Jackie.
Bye.
This is KHOI Community Radio. And this is Local Talk. And your hosts today are Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, and it's time to hear what Michelle Young had to say. She was a visitor from the Australian National University who came to study Iowa Learning Farms. I was fortunate enough to be able to join Gina for an interview with Michelle after her two-week visit to Iowa, and I think we were both surprised when Gina introduced herself.
I'm from Iowa, and I did one of those walkabout with a round-the-world ticket.
Oh, yes.
I'm traveling like a lot of Australians do.
Yeah.
And so I spent 6 months in Australia.
Oh, fabulous.
And I just loved it. Yes. And met a lot of the iffy in New Zealand and Australia. And then I worked mostly in Queensland. I worked at a cattle and sheep property in the outback of Australia.
Okay, so in the rangelands.
Huenden,
yes. Yeah, okay.
And where it's dry and then it rains and then all of a sudden it greens overnight.
And it's beautiful.
In Townsville, I worked at Cook's University for a couple of weeks. And then I taught in agronomy and ecology at Iowa State, in the sustainable agriculture.
Oh, okay.
And I love teaching and that's so I did that for 17, 18 years.
Right.
But anyway, so then I was on a contract, and they were budget cuts. So right now I'm working in real estate, but I still am involved as much as I can with teaching or local food systems. And
yeah, once you've got the bug, once it's your passion, I think it's ever going to leave you.
Yeah.
And that's why you can come and be a co-host on Local Talk, Gina. Then Michelle described farming in Australia and gave her impressions of what she'd seen through Iowa Learning Farms.
So my name's Michelle Young. I'm the director of the Sustainable Farms Project at the Australian National University. So the Australian National University is based in Canberra, and our project, Sustainable Farms, is a new initiative that's been designed and introduced to explore the relationships between managing natural assets on farms for biodiversity, profitability, and mental health and well-being outcomes. So the project comes out of a long study, some monitoring that's been done by Professor David Lindemeyer, who's an ecologist. He and his group have been monitoring mammals, birds, and reptiles for nearly two decades on farms, on over 270 farms that are in the boxgum grassy woodlands, which is sort of inland on the east coast of Australia. The significance of that work is that they've been able to look at the trends in biodiversity through that long-term monitoring. The study's unique. There's not many studies of that kind that have that long-term aspect to it. And because Australia is a land where we have the sort of boom and bust cycles of drought and rain, through those wet periods and those dry periods, they keep that monitoring going so they can detect the trend that stand out across the different seasons.
How long has this been going on?
So more than two decades. There's five different studies that they've been doing, and the first one started more than two decades ago. And as a result of those studies, the field ecologists who live and work in rural Australia and do the monitoring for Professor Lindemeyer, they've developed really good relationships with the farmers. And what those farmers were telling us is that if they manage their assets well, if they put trees back into the landscape and fence their creek lines and put vegetation around, I think what you call potholes or ponds, we call them dams, you know, indentations that hold water for livestock. If they do these things, then not only do they see the increases in biodiversity, but they actually get a lot of benefits for productivity. And the other benefit is for mental health and well-being. So our farmers, you know, they experienced some pretty tough times. We've had drought regularly. We're in a drought now. We had two major droughts last decade. So the importance of having these places on the farm where they can go, where there's nature, birds, you know, the opportunity to sit and listen to and watch the birds come through, they tell us that that's invaluable.
I heard you speak earlier today, and you mentioned Potter Farms. Is this part of your project, or was this what are part of Potter Farms?
Okay, so the Potter Farms take their name from a philanthropic trust called the Ian Potter Foundation. And the Ian Potter Foundation is, I suppose, by American standards, a sort of medium-sized trust that supports some different causes in Australia, and they have a focus on the environment. And back in the 80s, Australian farmers were having a lot of trouble with salinity then and rising water table. And so the Ian Potter Foundation, they funded a project called the Potter Farmland Plan. And that was all about showcasing these farms to farmers that provided examples of how you could plan for natural asset management, how you could plan your conservation efforts. And that was a highly successful project and ended up sort of supporting the development of land care groups across Australia, which is groups of farmers who get together and plan conservation efforts on their farm, work together to do that on their individual properties. So the Ian Potter Foundation was really interested to partner with the Australian National University to develop our project because they'd had such success in the past.
And what were some of the techniques they used for managing their farms?
They're not complicated engineering solutions. They're basically back to putting vegetation back into the landscape. So things like shelter belts. So shelter belts are planting tree lines that have understory on the borders of paddocks. And these shelter belts provide protection for livestock during lambing. So when the lambs are produced in Australia, it's during winter, and we often have frost events in these areas. So the shelter belts have actually been shown to have fantastic benefits for reducing lamb death, also increasing lamb survivals. They also have been shown to have benefits for pest management in cropping areas. And you know, there's a range of different benefits that people get from them for biodiversity in terms of the birds and our small mammals in that landscape that we're trying to bring back are these what are called squirrel gliders. They're like possums that have a wing under their arm and they make a large leap and they can, you know, jump, you know, quite large distances. Then these farms are in an agricultural landscape that was basically very devegetated, you know. So what we have is remaining paddock trees. So we have these big trees that might be 200 or 300, even 400 years old, and they're iconic trees that support a huge range of biodiversity. So tree planting is a big part of the, of what we're trying to promote. That was what was promoted through the farmland plan and what landcare groups have been continuing to work on. And there's been a large-scale restoration effort in terms of putting trees back into the landscape. With that said, though, the big trees are what support the biodiversity. The big trees in Australia have the hollows where branches have fallen off, which is where the parrots, large parrots, and the small mammals live, and those trees are essential to supporting biodiversity. So what we have currently is we have these scattered paddock trees, so remnant lone paddock trees sitting in the middle of a paddock, and they're under threat. So some of these trees are 200 or 300 years old, and when we have cattle grazing around them, the compaction, etc., means that they don't survive long, and so we're trying to keep those in the landscape while we bring these other trees on, because it'll take 200 years to bring trees up to their size to support some of the biodiversity we're trying to protect. So we have a lot of nesting boxes for squirrel gliders and parrots as well, but it's not the same as having a large tree.
So are you planting new trees?
Yes. So we have We've been doing this since the 80s through our land care groups. We have major restoration effort putting trees back into the landscape. So the original ecosystem was box gums, and they're a shorter woodland tree. And we're encouraging farmers, and farmers have been doing this with the government assistance through cost share programs, to put these trees along what we call shelter belt lines. You know, so along the edges of the paddocks or the cropping field. And what we've learnt through doing this is that we can't just plant the trees. We have to think about how the natural understory would have been, and that that's really important for supporting the ecosystem, that we have both the trees and an understory, so small bushes that provide protection for small birds. Otherwise, we end up with some of the bigger birds becoming tyrants and basically, taking over the territory. So we've learned a lot about how to do this well and successfully, and also at the same time how those trees can support agriculture through reducing, you know, deaths at lambing times. So farmers that have put in these shelter belts report having much higher rates of lamb survival, particularly the twinners, you know, during the winter when we do our lambing. And so there's big advantages for farmers to do this, not just from the biodiversity points of view, but also for the productivity. It's not so much the trees that where people work on with respect to the water retention and the soil improvements. It's actually the native perennial pastures. So when we introduced European agricultural systems, we took out a lot of the perennial grasses, the deep-rooted perennials that had been in the system previously. That was part of the reason why we had a rising water table. So it's not... And so what we're encouraging farmers to do in their pastures is to get more diversity into their pastures, get more perennials, more of these deep-rooted plants. And I've definitely been on farms during this very current drought where I've been on, you know, most farms look very bare and hard and the land's hard and compacted. And I've been into pastures that have got a rich diversity of these native perennials, and it's like walking on a spongy surface. So it's about putting those natural things, what was meant to be there, back into it if you want to get the best results. Land clearing is still an issue in Australia. In our own project, when we started off, we know there's been a lot of groups who've done great work, and there've been an enormous restoration effort. So there's a lot of trees that have gone into the ground, and that's fantastic. There's still more work to be done, of course, and we wanted to try and reach out to people who maybe hadn't been involved in this sort of thing before. But what we have also come to be aware of is that some of the next generation of farmers, they're not necessarily seeing the value of these assets, of the trees in the ground. And so there's been some examples where farms that we've worked with who've been very well revegetated have had the younger generation come in and clear the land again. So what that reminds us of is that not just that we need to find how to work with people who are not currently involved, but we have to clear of that. Because a lot of the information that farmers would get in our agricultural colleges would be about, you know, the importance of the Australian producer being efficient and effective and being a major supplier to meet world food demand for food in the world.
Right, unless they're getting less information on the importance of the wildlife and the trees and the benefits of biodiversity in their
grazing systems?
Yes, we have a different system there, like at Iowa State. I mean, I've been amazed to see what an incredible system you have here, where you've got the different disciplines working next to each other, agronomy working next to your wildlife biologists. It's very well integrated and quite impressive, you know. I've been really wowed by how they do it here. So ours are a bit more siloed. We've got the agricultural colleges that are talking about agronomy and animal sciences, and then we've got our ecologists in different universities.
Yes.
So this project, we're trying to bring that together. That's very much part of what we're trying to do, is to bring that together. We're also not as lucky as you are here in Iowa in terms of extension. Your research scientists are very involved in extension work. I think, you know, we do have extension, but not to the level that you have here. So that's why I've come, basically, because you're a centre of excellence in terms of extension. We've always been talking to farmers, but mm-hmm. talking to them in a way that's very methodical, you know, where we've got clear outcomes of and we can measure that. When I found the Iowa Learning Farms Project online, I was impressed with how streamlined that, you know, they had developed materials where they are very efficient in terms of getting farmers to talk to each other, because it's farmers who learn from farmers, but bringing that science in behind it so that, you know, farmers could actually get their observations supported with the science, and then having a really good evaluation protocol. It's just asking a few key questions about what's changed since they have participated in their program. Yeah, so that's why I'm here. And I've been incredibly impressed with the way that they deliver the science through interactive displays. You know, there's not endless brochures or pamphlets. There's kind of real hands-on displays where people can see how things work with their trailers. So, yeah, so I've got quite a bit of information to take home. They've also got these videos online about where scientists are sort of chatting to their dogs. And so they're bringing science into maybe a different forum. They're not keeping it elevated in the institutions. So, yeah, so it's been a great trip for me.
What are some of the key things that you think you can implement in your program in Australia?
Well, I think the way that Iowa Learning Farms has is working not just with the farmers but with the community. So that's one of the things. You know, we're focused on the farmers, but I think we need to take the community with us. So I want to look more at how we can try and do that, working without the school children. We were doing a little bit of that, but I think this has convinced me that we need to do more. And, you know, just try and maybe get more into that creative space a bit more. I'm not sure how we're going to do it, but you know, bringing it into that art and music side of things and not just keeping it, you know, as we're saying, in the facts and figures.
What are some ideas that you can use this drought that you're having now maybe to educate more farmers? I mean, is there any way to have, like, field days at this place that has diversity?
Oh, that's what we do. So we've had about 18 field days. Some of them have been breakfast with the birds, where our field ecologists will put on a morning, I think we call it a barbecue, you call it a grill.
Yeah.
So we'll have bacon and egg sandwiches, you know, after you do a sunset tour around a farm and you get to identify the birds. It's bringing back that. So probably people are losing knowledge about bird species, so giving people the opportunity to learn more about what they've got on their farms. One of the things the field ecologists say to me all the time is that people just don't know what they've got. And when they get out there with someone who knows and can identify things, they're like, really? And so opening their eyes to the things that are there. So we've done those breakfasts with the birds, and we've done a lot of field days on the farm dams. What we call a dam is not a dam on a river. It's a pond or a depression that's created with excavation. So we've been showcasing to farmers the water quality benefits of putting the vegetation around the walls of the farm dam or pond and fencing it, so you're restricting access to only a certain hardened point for the livestock. So that reduces the sort of sediment inflows. And you know, we've got reason to believe that farmers who invest in these new structures that are deeper with this kind of bordering vegetation, you know, they can improve their water security. You know, the water persistence is much higher because evaporation is lower, and also the water quality, the water temperature is lower. Stock aren't walking into the center and fouling the water. So, you know, there's great productivity benefits from that. And so we've been having our field days around that, and we've had huge interest. What we try and do is make sure we've got vets and agronomists, agricultural scientists at these events so people can have these conversations about, okay, it's important for biodiversity. So we've got our ecologists talking about that. We've got these animal science experts and agronomists talking about the productivity benefits, the farmer talking about the challenges and how he's got round them or she's got round them and how they, you know, what they've experienced. And we're bringing people into conversation to create these conversations that are not just one-dimensional around production.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and our last guest is David Bruner. We've just, in case you just tuned in, we have just been talking with Michelle Young from Australia. David is from the Plant Introduction Research Station at ISU. He's designated as curator for amaranth at the Plant Introduction Station. Hi, David.
Good morning. Good morning.
I thought of you when I read the following passage from a publication called Country Folks, and this is 2014, so maybe it's a little out of date, and you can tell us what's happened with amaranth since the perfect weed was discovered. Pigweed is not grown in these trial fields, but samples have been brought in. It's unbelievable. It's horrible. It's terrible, said a Pennsylvania farmer. We have to rotate completely different crops just trying to clean out that one weed. In the southern parts of Mississippi and Arkansas, they have clocked 3 inches of growth per day, added Penn State weed specialist Dwight Lingenfelder. It is less ambitious in the Keystone State, largely due to density and frequency of humidity, far different from the Deep South. Perhaps it will only grow an inch a day in Pennsylvania. Containing new infestations and preventing its spread is a critical first step in managing this threat, the literature tells us. The risk from this new weed comes from its competitive growth habit. Prolific seed production, greater than 100,000 seeds per plant, along with its potential resistance to Roundup and other glyphosates and the group 2 herbicides, ALS inhibitors. Lingenfelder referenced the Palmer, that's the Palmer amaranth, as being roughly 6 feet tall, but said it could rise to 8 feet and possibly higher. Since I know that pigweed is a variety of amaranth, and as curator of amaranth seeds, how do you react to that, David?
The amaranths really are aggressively growing. They make lots and lots of seeds, and this allows them to evolve fast because every single seed is a different experiment, and they can therefore get herbicide resistance evolving. And some of them have separate male and female plants, so they're able to throw clouds of pollen across long distances with herbicide resistance traits in this pollen cloud. And wherever it lands and sets a seed, there's a little bit more herbicide resistance. The seeds are so small, they're everywhere. They're probably on your feet right now. People are just tracking them. They're moving their own equipment. This wasn't a huge problem until agriculture became so dependent on these herbicides, and then the amaranths were among the first to evolve the resistance to the herbicides, although a lot of weeds are doing it. I understand that since this article came out in 2014, there's been switched to another mode of action of herbicides, something called dicamba, which has the amaranths beaten back at least some places sometimes with some crops, but it's a temporary thing because the amaranths are still evolving. They haven't given up yet.
Well, now, it sounds like something very dangerous.
I don't feel it's dangerous, but I'm on the amaranth side of things. It's also a crop plant. It's a food plant. The seeds are very nutritious as a porridge-like food, and they're popped like popcorn, and they're used happily in many parts of the world, especially Mexico. And the leaves are also a vegetable, a major vegetable in the tropics and subtropics. They like it hot. Unlike most of our vegetables that we grow here in Iowa, they are adapted to hot, humid conditions. So they do well in the tropics, and they're just so easy to grow with the prolific seed production. So you can get a lot of yield of a very nutritious vegetable that's not only got vitamins and minerals, but it's high in protein. So it's kind of your steak, too, besides being just a leafy vegetable.
Well, you said that is a food crop in Mexico?
Yes.
I kind of remember you went to Mexico a couple of years ago. What was that for?
Last October, I was invited to an Amaranth conference in Mexico, in Puebla, and they had 300 or 400 people. And part of the reason it was such a big, exciting, high-energy Amaranth conference is that the incoming Mexican administration was promoting amaranth as part of a basket of food for people to eat. And Mexico has long been a point of pride, a national food that they want to feature. And it's a way of counteracting what to them is the big problem of obesity, partly from drinking so much Coca-Cola there, that the amaranth would be a more nutritious food, would counteract the obesity problem. And as a point of pride, it's Mexican for Mexicans, and they love it that way.
And it's not likely to be taken over and genetically modified for production in the United States to export to Mexico.
It's not likely. There was a pretty big amaranth industry in especially western Nebraska, and it's mostly fizzled away. So there's no big producers left. The grain amaranth in our stores comes mostly from India, and it's superb quality. Relatively big, bright grains and low cost. It's around the price of rolled oats, where it used to be a real premium, expensive thing. So I look for more amaranth in people's diets just because it's in the price range where people that compound foods can use it as an ingredient, and it has tremendous nutritional benefits. But you're right. It's not being produced in the United States. These things drift around the planet, and just where it's produced and exported is hard to predict. It depends a lot on where entrepreneurial people take things up.
And what does it taste like?
It's got a little bit of a hint of beets. There's a chemical in beets called geosmin, which gives it that earthy flavor, which I personally like and some people don't like at all. But you can taste a little bit of it in the leaves, a little bit in the grain. And it's a reason they can't use it at a very high percentage in cookies and things, because it makes them taste kind of mousy. So they have to keep it down to around 10 or 25% for most baked goods. But that's what it's like, and maybe someday there'll be new kinds come out that have less of the geosmin. It makes a really nice porridge, but not a whole lot of flavor, really. You could add spices for it.
Well, there's another quality that I read about. They were talking about these very tall plants, and I remember that several years ago that you had made it to the Guinness Book of World Records for a very tall parsley plant. How tall was that parsley plant?
The parsley plant was about 7 feet tall, and it's since been beaten out in the Guinness World Book of World Records, but I think the record's still beatable. And to me, the picture of the one in the Guinness Book of World Records from Canada looked like they'd switched to another plant, and it wasn't really parsley, but that's just what I say looking at the picture. In any case, I'm no longer the Guinness World Record for parsley or for amaranth, but I was for amaranth also for a while.
Okay, how tall was your amaranth?
It was around 15 feet, and it was a special kind of amaranth, Amaranthus australis, which grows in swamps. So the seeds were collected near Gainesville, Florida, where they grow even in standing water, and it's a hollow stem. So there's a hollow stem with air there below water level. It's presumably evolved to transmit gases to the roots, but they grow enormous. Hollow stem, they almost never break, and still annuals and the next Guinness World Record person used my same seed lot. I sent him seeds from part of my job as an amaranth seed curator, and he beat me out by some feet. He made a better effort than I did.
Well, did you try to grow that amaranth, or how did you do it here in Iowa without a swamp?
It adapts to dry land. The roots are so active that especially when the soil's wet, you see the little roots coming up between the rows, carpeting the soil and coming up for air, it seems, between the rows. It doesn't need to be in a swamp.
And is this a danger to Iowa crops?
I don't think so. It's never been a weed anywhere, this particular species. And I was instructed very strongly by my boss to cut them down before they flowered so we weren't getting seeds all over the county. Only a few plants have been able to evolve weediness, and most of the world's plants are wild and just don't become problems for farmers or anybody.
That is a very interesting perspective. When I used to have a garden, I considered weeding a great choice? Is this a flower or is this a weed?
I'm the same way. I often change sides as I go along. And it makes my garden a bit of a mess, but I want to see what it's going to grow up into.
This is David Brenner. Tell your exact title. I had trouble with that.
I'm a curator at the North Central Regional Plant Introduction Station, which is here in Ames, a partnership between the United States Department of Agriculture and Iowa State University and North Central States. We're a gene bank with thousands and thousands of glass jars of seeds, of especially corn and sunflower and melon. But I work with mostly minor crops, parsley, dill, fennel, lots of crop wild relatives. And I do a lot of growing plants to get fresh seed stocks. I've got a big field of coriander out now where I'm growing fresh coriander seeds to replace the ones that were aging.
Thank you for being with us today, David.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were
Jackie Comito,
Michelle Young, and David Brenner, as well as John Hala, David Martin, Amber Corrieri, Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, Don Com, and Irv Kloss.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles from their CD, Abbey Road.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. We're always ready for donations, so just look for that yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.